Today's episode of the BVA Boardroom Podcast, we have a very special guest, Odette Bellano, the CEO of St. Alphonsus Trinity Health West Region. Listen, Odette is a dear friend. This is kind of a farewell episode. She just announced her retirement. She has been an amazing leader here in the Treasure Valley and in healthcare. I'm going to read a little bit about her her experience. She began her career as a nurse. She was an ICU nurse, received her bachelor's degree from TCU. Then she earned her master's degree. She's a fellow of the American College of Healthcare Executives. She serves for several local and state organizations, the Idaho Hospital Association, former chair and current board member of the Boise Metro Chamber of Commerce, Boise Valley Economic Partnership, Idaho Business for Education, Boise State Foundation Board, and Boise State University College of Health Sciences Board of Ambassadors. She's a member of the Carol Emmett Fellowship Board, which is a national organization that tries to promote women in healthcare. She'll talk a little bit about that on the podcast. And she's been recognized by literally every who's who, top 25 in everything, top 10, top everything healthcare executives in the country. Again, just a wonderful dear friend, and wanted to have her on as she says goodbye to her current role at St. Al's and to all of her great friends that have been able to rub shoulders with her in the Valley. So hope you enjoy this, Odette Bellano. This is going to be fun.
Absolutely.
Joining me today is Odette Bellano, a good friend, most importantly, and the CEO of St. Alphonsus Trinity Health West Region, and recently announced her retirement. And I think everyone's in mourning. We were just talking about Bobby Joe from the Chamber was on, and she's like, oh, I'm going to miss Odette so much. Everywhere I go, I'm hearing the same thing. Oh. You've made quite an impression on everyone you've interacted with.
Well, thank you.
What does it feel like to transition?
You know, I think that we all go through milestones in our life, and you know, I had made a commitment to my family that I would retire in January of 2023, which meant that I would have given Trinity a year, which would have been around December 2021. Well, we all know what we were experiencing at that time. And I refused to leave my career in the middle of the most incredible crisis in healthcare to date, at least in my lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
And so I delayed until January of 24, when I told my boss in October or November of 22, he was in denial. And, you know, I think it was important for me to get back to my parents, who are 91 and still independent. And I had delayed a year, but I committed because I love this organization and I love Boise so much that I would stay an extra 6 months, so till June 30th. Help them through the transition. And quite frankly, being somewhat remote and traveling has given me a good platform for a transition versus just a jumping off the cliff.
Kind of making them get used to it.
Yes, yes.
Well, so you, I do, your parents have got to be very proud of you. And I want to talk a little bit about your career. I'm going to read your bio before our intro on the podcast, but you started in healthcare.
Yes.
And started as a nurse. And talk us through why healthcare? Because knowing you like I do, I think that passion for people and patients and care is what's driven you. It's been your why the entire time. And then the transition into administration and how that happened. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah. Well, actually, I went into nursing knowing that I wanted to be a CEO. So my family is all medical. I say, you know, I was maybe a boring person and just kind of followed in the footsteps that I knew. But I saw, you know, my father is a physician, uncles are physicians, my mother was a director of laboratory services. So there's just an expectation that we would go into healthcare. That's just, you know, a family of service. But I knew that I wanted to lead people. And I thought that the best way to lead in healthcare was to be a clinician and to really understand the plight of physicians and nurses. And while I know great CEOs that are business people and not clinical, I felt that the way I process and the way that I function to be somebody clinical gave me that power to have the ability to move forward in my final destination of being a CEO.
That's amazing. And what, I have a lot of questions to ask, but talk about healthcare and how it's changed.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, I look back, you know, I'm in the 80s going to medical school and then got out in the 90s. And I look at just the changes that have happened since I was in, and it's been incredible. But I remind people all the time, when I was in medical school, we didn't have email. Right? Then we got out, we had cell phone. I remember the first time I had a phone instead of a pager, and how quickly, you know, we've had a tremendous amount of technology change. I remember the first electronic medical record in the ER, and how different that was than paper. And all of these things that were supposed to make it better and more streamlined, I think it has, for sure. I mean, think about how you had to look up old labs or old records or whatever in the old days. But it's changed from a business perspective. It's also changed from an insurance perspective, as we've gone from fee-for-service for 60 years with the crosses, and now we're into this, you know, value-based care. It's changed from a technology with healthcare. You know, you're the trauma hospital. You watch just how trauma patients have been cared for differently over that 40 years. I like to think, Odette, maybe I'm naive, that patient care hasn't changed that much, though, meaning that real interaction where you have someone in need and they come to you because they're in need. It might be a mental health issue. It might be a heart attack. It might be a trauma, but they're there and they need help. I think that's still the same, isn't it?
I totally agree with you. You know, I also was in nursing school in the 80s, right? And I think that we've had a lot of technology come at us that helps us, but it really is the tap on the shoulder, the confidence, the conversation, the compassion, right? That really is healthcare, right? We can have all the tools and still not interact in a way that is beneficial for that patient and that family to feel cared for and trust, right? I think that the complexity of a $4.7 trillion industry carries a lot of great things and a lot of bad things, mm-hmm. right? So there's been a lot of disruption. So I remember sitting in my master's class, and I tell this story a lot, and this was in the early 90s, and a professor said, one of these days, hospitals will be these just giant emergency rooms and ICUs. And all the other healthcare will take place outside of the building. And I was like, what? What does that mean, right? And we're getting there, right? Yeah. We have much more happening virtually. You know, we're talking about robotic surgery happening from, I don't know, Wisconsin, right, in Texas or whatever it is. We now have tools that allow us to make decisions faster. We have a lot more a technology that allows us to care for patients in a way that, you know, we used to keep cataract patients for a week in the hospital, right? With sandbags next to their ears so they wouldn't move. And now we send them home, they're being done in an ambulatory surgery center. And those are all great things that technology allows us to move forward. But the complexity of how healthcare is funded and the issues that we have with understanding that we can no longer survive as a, you know, the GMP, what is it, almost 20% goes to healthcare, and we have to change it, yet we as a society have been somewhat resistant and still focus on sick care versus preventative. And I think we're getting more and more to, we have to get to that total cost of care and that value proposition versus just a fee for service. And we're moving slowly. You know, I read an article the other day that alternative payment systems, right, where we're talking about total cost of care, getting paid for the quality, they've been out there for 10 years.
Yeah.
But the needle hasn't really moved, right? So why is that? And how do we accelerate that to reduce the cost of care and really do more preventative care? So I think, you know, I used to be the youngest person in the room, and now I'm the oldest person in the room. I'm like, how did that happen? And, you know, the gifts that young people bring with the innovative ideas of, you know, understanding differently how we can deliver care, I think is really the silver lining in all the crisis that we were having. Mm. And I think something like COVID made us think differently about things that were taking us years and years and years to move on. So, you know, telemedicine was out there for many, many years before COVID. When COVID came, it accelerated it, right? So there are some good things that came out of how we learn to move quickly and change healthcare. And I think that the next generation, I hope, will do a great job of moving things forward.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. But now you have these doctors. I mean, I go to my doctor now and I'm like, he looks way too young to be taking care of me, right? But I think that they did come up differently. And I think they do see the world differently from technology. They've never known anything differently but technology. And hopefully that changes. I want to go back a little bit to COVID. It did so many amazing things. It was a disruptor of so many industries because it forced you to do things that may have taken decades otherwise. There were also some real negatives for healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't practice full time anymore, but I still have all my friends do. And when I'm with them, I hear these stories that just make me sad, where they'll say that there was a change during COVID from, you trusted what your doctor was telling you. You trusted, hey, I'm the doctor. I went to school for this, and you know, and this is what I think you have, and this is why you need to do the treatment. And they're having a hard time now because I think that's kind of changed a little bit. I think in society with social media and the ability to kind of say and do what you want to do, it's just different for them now. Now they're ER doctors, so they're on the front lines. But talk a little bit about how the negatives of COVID have lingered in the profession.
Yeah. So I think the mistrust is really big, you know, and I'm proud to serve on the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, and our whole book of work is around misinformation, distrust of the industry. How do we get past that? What is it that we need to do to really gain that trust back? Because physicians and clinicians do go to school for a long time. They're well educated, and now they're being challenged. The incivility that we see in our hospitals. When I was an ICU nurse back in the day, I didn't even know what the word workplace violence meant. Mm. And today, a nurse, two nurses every hour are assaulted while they're providing care in emergency rooms. The amount of burnout, I think across the country, many industries identified with the burnout, but the burnout of the constant of seeing a lot of death, a lot of dynamics that was difficult to deal with, the issues on diversity, equity, you know, inclusion, all the, you know, the George Floyd, all those things continued to just erupt in healthcare. And we already had a shortage, right, of physicians and nurses. And I think people, while we hear people are going into healthcare, they're using it as a vehicle to get to something else, whether it's the insurance companies, pharma, you know, case management, other things, not bedside nursing. There was a study conducted in Idaho that said only 2% of the nurses that are coming out want to go to bedside nursing, right? And this is where we need our clinicians. You know, in your darkest days where you need that clinician at your side, we need people at the bedside to deliver that care. So I think, you know, we are constantly trying to gauge where people are. How do we help them? I think, you know, the things that we've seen from a burnout and a morale distress and fatigue, I mean, it's a real thing. And we equate it to people in the war zone and that moral fatigue that they felt, right, while they're in the war zone. I don't know if we're ever going to really recover from it. I think we're giving people tools to deal with it differently. And we hope that, you know, in our society, we get to a better place around how do we treat each other? How do we respect the people that are serving us every single day?
Yeah, listen, it was already hard.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I mean, I did all night shifts for 10 years when I first came out. And, you know, it was not an easy job. I mean, you every room you went in, it could be something different. That's where people died, was in the ER. It's where the challenging things happened, from diagnoses to challenging social interactions, finding dispositions for people, just because you had people there of all walks of life trying to figure out what they were going to do. And so it was already pretty stressful. I can't imagine, on top of that, going in and sitting down on a stool in front of a patient and saying, okay, here's what I think you have, and here's what I think we should do, and have them say, I don't believe you. I think that level of frustration would be hard for a lot of people. So hopefully it does change. I also, as you're talking, it's so great to have you on. I didn't think about this, but if you look at healthcare 40 years ago, when we started, and healthcare now, you think about how many layers of different jobs there are that mm-hmm. weren't in the industry now. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but you've got a lot of practitioners that are going through and taking these jobs, whether it be case management or outside just jobs that aren't directly dealing with patients. Yeah. And there's probably no end to those jobs. So so we need to have those that stay. I'm going to ask you a question, because you've been with Trinity for how many years now?
8 years.
8 years. I got to go with you back to headquarters in yes. Michigan. And I was so impressed, because when I got there, we met your leadership team, and you started the meeting with a leadership minute.
Yeah.
Mission
reflection.
Minute.
Reflection.
A reflection. Mm-hmm. I got lucky that day. I'll tell you a funny story. I've never told you this, but that morning I happened to be doing a thought at the Meridian prayer breakfast. So I had prepared this very nice package thing, and we got back there at the meeting, and they said, hey, does anyone want to give a message? And I had one prepared. When I got done, Courtney's like, where'd you pull that out of? How'd you have that? And I said, oh.
I was very impressed.
It's only because I had it prepared for that morning, but very mission driven.
Mm-hmm.
Has that helped you with Trinity and recruitment? Because there are really good people. I get people all the time that say to me, hey, you left healthcare, why did you leave? And would you recommend my daughter or my son or myself going into it? I loved healthcare. Has it helped you with having a mission that's driven with people to attract people? There's still really good people out there that just want to take care of people.
Yeah. You know, in my life, in my career, I started in for-profit healthcare for 11 and a half years. And I said, wow, there needs to be something different, right, in healthcare. I mean, there are some great for-profit companies out there. And so I went to Ascension Health, which was my first Catholic health system, and I was with them for 11 and a half years. And it was really enlightening to really be focused on a mission, to have those core values. I then left and went to Kaiser, because I thought for-profit, non-for-profit, now I get to do virtual, vertically integrated. We all talked about it. We didn't know what it was. Kaiser is an amazing organization. But I felt a hole in my heart mm-hmm. about where my values were and whether I aligned with Kaiser, who's, again, a great organization. So I came back to Trinity, and I actually landed. I thought about this when I was thinking about today. I landed in Boise by happenstance.
Hmm.
And it has been the most fulfilling part of my entire career, to be here, to be part of Trinity, to be part of St. Alphonsus. I think that we really live our mission every single day. We remind ourselves about it being a healing and transforming guidance to everyone that we touch in our community. We talk about our core values. And for me, we have 6 core values. The most important for me that I talk about a lot is reverence, dignity of all people, dignity and respect for all people, right? We don't judge who comes through our doors. We're there to help them in whatever state, wherever we'll meet them where they are, to help them. And to start with a reflection every day, to settle ourselves into knowing that there's a reason why we're here, we have a mission that we honor, and that we want to be part of this community for it to be a healthy community moving forward, right? And that's what drives me every day. I think we as people look for purpose in our lives, whether people believe it or not. I think everybody wants a purpose. And I, we're not perfect. Jesus hung out, right, with the sinners. But every day we wake up, I think, to do the right thing and to be in a very mission-driven organization. As a Catholic healthcare organization, we have a lot of rituals, right? We don't expect everybody to be Catholic. We want people to respect, what we believe in. And I think that that just helps people. I think when you walk into a Catholic hospital, there's just a little bit of a different feel.
Yeah. And there is nothing like patient care.
Right.
There is nothing like, of the things that I miss, I miss the camaraderie of a night shift team in healthcare. You would go in feeling like the world was against you and real team atmosphere. But what I miss most is walking into a room and sitting down with somebody that you've never met before, and looking them in the eyes and having them tell you how you could help them. And sometimes it wasn't what was on the chief complaint. Sometimes it was nothing to do with what was on the chief complaint. But I always felt my job was to meet them where they were and try to find out why they were there and try to help them in a real genuine way. And there's just nothing like that. I'll tell you, I wasn't going to tell a story, but it's a funny story. I'd always wanted to be a pediatrician and ended up having a mentor in medical school that talked me into becoming an ER doc. And so that's just what I did. And when you come out, I mean, you go through school a long ways. I didn't know any doctors in my family on either side. They were all worked at the Kennecott Copper Mine, so I had no real mentors. When I came out, you get a little bit of an ego because you're the doctor now and you're seeing patients and you're busy and everyone's kind of answering to you. And I was visiting my grandmother, and at the time she was in her 80s. And she asked me a question. She said, when do you find time on your shift to pray for your patients? Mm. And I looked at her, I said, what are you talking about, Grandma? And she's like, when do you find time on your shift? As busy you are, because she was asking about my night shifts. And I said, I don't pray for my patients when I'm on a shift. And she looked at me and she said, shame on you. She's like, I'm going to ask you to start doing that more often. And I want to see how that changes how you're interacting.
Wow.
And I'll never forget like the next night shift I worked, because you have some really challenging cases, and just finding a quiet spot and just saying a little prayer to say, hey, help me, help this family, and putting faith back into that interaction. And it was life-changing for me. And it made me remind myself that we are just servants here of each other. We're taking care of each other. We're trying to make the world a better place, whether we're in healthcare or something else. But that's really what it's about. And I would encourage, I sure you would echo this too, anyone thinking about going into healthcare, there are so many different ways to be in where you can take care. And there's nothing like it in almost any other part of life that I know of where you can really affect someone's life in a real meaningful way, save their life.
Yeah.
It sounds dramatic sometimes, but you really are, whether that's emotionally, mentally, physically, you're saving their lives. But
I have to share with you. So I do something that's called a reflection, and it's every 2 weeks I write a letter to the organization. And I think that what fulfills my heart, right, because I'm not at the bedside anymore, is I feature two or three incredibly touching stories that just reflect what's happening in our halls every hour of the day, right? And it is so incredible to hear some of these stories from the voices of the family or the patient about how a nurse, because she touched their shoulder or sat with them or treated them in a dignified manner, made such a difference to them, right? And that is what we're all about, right? Is can you touch a life, and every single life, do something to make it better, even if it's just for the moment, and even when the news is not a great, you know, great outcome.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I'm going to ask you, I've never talked to you about this, but in healthcare, I've kind of had two careers, right? Healthcare and then business. And in healthcare, there are a lot of women leaders. There just are. I mean, I think of almost every hospital I was in, I had women as my leaders. When I came to Boise, Bonnie Carnes she ran our group for 20 years. She was our leader in nursing, in the hospitals. Almost all of the really strong leaders are women. And so it's a very natural thing. And I always had a tremendous amount of respect. And then you get in the business world and you find that it's not so much that way. It's not. It's more patriarchal. It's more traditional, whatever. But I've never really asked you, did you experience, when you came up through healthcare, how was it being a CEO and a woman? And then in Idaho, specifically Boise, how was it here being amongst your peers?
Yeah. So I have to tell you a funny story. The first time that I felt that I was ready to become a president of a hospital, and I felt I was well prepared. I went, there was an opening. I won't tell the company. There was an opening, and I went to the regional president and said, I'd like to apply for that position. And he said to me, I will never forget, he said, you are probably the most qualified, but I need a man in the role. I left 1 year later from that organization to my first president role. So that was really the first time I felt like, wow, you know, there's maybe a difference, right, of that. You know, there's very few women CEOs in healthcare, even though predominantly healthcare, 60% of healthcare is nurses or, you know, women. My second incident, I was already a CEO, and we had a group purchasing organization that we all were partners in. And I had just joined this organization, and we usually, before the board meeting, had a dinner, and then the board meeting the next day. This was in good old Texas, and I love Texas, right? I consider myself a Texan. I walked into the room for dinner, and I was conversing with several of the CEOs that I knew, but I wasn't really paying attention to the dynamics of the room. I was just, you know, meeting and greeting people. And somebody who I knew very well that was in the room came and whispered in my ear and said, Odette, we cannot sit down for dinner until you do. And I looked around the room and I saw that I was the only female in the room. So the next day at the board meeting, I was feeling a little bit of an imposter issue, of feeling a little bit different based on that interaction the night before. So I think that, you know, we haven't made the progress in healthcare for women as much as I think we would be in 2023.
That surprises me.
Very surprising. I'm also on the board, and I was on the forming board of the Carol Emmett Foundation. Carol Emmett was a female recruiter in the healthcare, nationally known, and she had a passion for women leaders. And her family established a foundation, and it's a national foundation, and we've done an incredible job where we take executive women in healthcare that are already doing great leadership and help them move into the next level, right? So I'm really committed to helping women that want to continue their careers in leadership, because I think that we still have
long
way
problems,
you know, in being able to get women into CEO positions.
How is it here amongst your peers?
I think my peers in the industry were very engaging, and, you know, we have had several CEOs that were women in healthcare here in Idaho. So I haven't really felt different, and I don't want to be colored by that, right? Yeah. I want to be my own self, prove myself on my own merit, female, not female, whatever, right? And so I really tend to not really focus on it, but I am very passionate about developing women into leadership.
I'm gonna shift, because this is a good segue. I've been around a lot of people, healthcare or not healthcare, lots of different industries. I would put you at the top of the list as a leader who is genuine, fearless, inspiring. You lift others everywhere you go, and whether that is in a, you know, Boise Chamber event, or whether that's with some of the Idaho Leader United thing we do within healthcare, within the business community, you are the go-to. I think that's why everyone is so sad.
Humbling.
Everyone is so sad right now. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. But what is it? Where does that fire come from? Where is that motivation? And teach us a little bit about why you are so fearless as a leader.
Wow. I mean, that's I don't know. I think it's in my upbringing, right? My family immigrated from Colombia in the 60s. I was, you know, 8 years old. And we felt that we were coming to the most incredible country. And I still today believe that we live in the most incredible country in the world. And I think when you're an immigrant, I saw my parents trying to prove themselves, or, you know, needing or feeling that they had to prove themselves. My father's a pediatrician, by the way, you know, and I think I have a special place in my heart for pediatricians, because they do it because they love it. they're not making a lot of money. So I think that my family inspired me to be excellent at whatever I was doing. And I think that I've carried that through in everything that I do. I'm passionate about everything that I do. I hope that I bring people along. But you know what? Leadership is a journey. I would say that the leader that I am as I'm ending my career was not the leader that I was 25 years ago. I had a lot of humbling experiences, and I believe that those humbling experiences and those hard lessons are necessary to make you a better leader, right?
Yeah. Wisdom comes from bad experiences. Amen. And bad experiences come from lack of wisdom, right? I mean, they go together. Gosh, I bet your parents are so proud of you. Are they, and you're going to spend more time with them now?
Yeah.
Be close by.
Yeah, you know, it's an important time, milestone in their lives, you know, and I have been privileged to spend my career, building my career, and going across the country wherever I felt I was, you know, going to do the best for community and do the best for myself. So I say it's time for me to go back home and, you know, spend some time with them, get to know my grandchildren. My son is a reconstructive plastic surgeon. He's moving, you know, he'll be out at his last fellowship in July. He'll be moving to San Antonio. My daughter lives in Austin. So I just, you know, my goal is to really still give back in whatever ways I find in healthcare, because that's been my life for 45 years. You just don't turn it off. But spend a little bit more time with family.
How old are your grandkids?
One was born the day before Thanksgiving this year, and then the other are 4 and 2.
So I have a 4 and 2. I think we've talked about this. And we went to Disneyland last weekend.
Oh, God.
And my 4-year-old sleeps with me and my wife at night instead of with his parents. And he wakes up at 5:30 every morning, and he goes all day long, and it was just wonderful. But we just got back yesterday, so I'm still coming off that. But magical.
Yeah.
Like, they tell you how good it's going to be. Remember those people showing you the pictures of their grandkids? You're like, and now you are one of those. Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm really happy for you. Well, thank you so much for what you've done in our community. On behalf of everyone who knows you, there's not any words to tell what you've meant to this place. I'm glad you're still going to be coming back.
Yes.
You're on the Idaho Power Board, right? And so you'll still be coming back here and visiting often. But just really happy for you to go and do the next chapter, and wanted to have you on to tell you thanks on behalf of everyone I know that knows you well, how much we love and appreciate what you've done.
Well, Boise's been great for me also, so thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for coming on today. Appreciate it.